Good evening to you all. Happy Shabbat. Hello, James, Kirk, and Larry. How are you guys?
Good evening.
Doing good.
Good evening.
It's all good.
It's all good. Well, great. I thought we'd pick up where we ended a week ago. I'm hoping that JB, Kirk, and Larry, that you all got my both the email and a note that I'm only going to be able to be with you for the first 30 to 40 minutes of tonight's program.
Yeah.
But, Larry, I've heard you in particular talk about this, and Kirk, you and I have talked about on Shattering Mess. We're going to be speaking of the ongoing relationship between Noah and Yahweh, and you guys know it like the back of your hand. So I'm hoping you guys can carry on for me. My son is in town, and I had promised that I would spend this this evening with him. Where we left off was... Go ahead.
I said I can't blame you there.
I don't get a chance to spend a lot of time with him because we're over 1,000 miles apart, and he's in town, and so I'm able to do it. So I'd like to, and he has an evening planned. This begins. So Yahweh said, "I will eliminate the man whom relationally I have created from upon the face of the ground, the Adamah, because the man has preyed upon those living creatures who move about and wing creatures who fly in the sky. Indeed, because I am grieved, regretting having made them." Now, the first thing I was curious when I read this was, what tense was Ma'ah written in? Ma'ah was, I will eliminate, which means I'm going to blot out. I'm going to annihilate, exterminate, wipe out, end the existence of, remove the impurity of. And so God is saying that, you know, he's not going to punish these people. So this is not I'm not going to, he didn't say I'm going to send them to Sheol where their souls will be tormented forever. He just says he's going to end their existence. So I wanted to read this and decide, well, how did he write it? And there were two real surprises in it. One of the surprises was not the the stem. The stem was the call stem. I mean, literally, I'm going to do this. I'm not. This is not a pretend hypothetical here. I'm not telling you a metaphor, a story, or a parable. I'm actually going to do this. So that's not a surprise. But wouldn't you have thought that that perhaps this had been written in the perfect? You know, at this moment, for this one time, I'm going to do this.
One and done, yeah.
One and done. It wasn't written in the perfect. It was written in the imperfect. So what that says is that while God is going to, and did, has now, wiped out these scum, eliminated them, destroyed them, annihilated them, you know, terminated their souls, so their souls no longer exist. He's not saying this is one and done.
So in other words, it could happen again.
It will happen again. It will happen again. And my guess is that it's not just that Yahweh was going to do it during the tribulation. I think he did it during the Exodus.
Mm-hmm.
I think he'll do it during the Magog War. I think he'll do it during Armageddon. I think that that many of those whom have been killed over the ages, Yahweh simply said, you know, you're scum. I don't know you. I want no part of you. You know, I'm not going to see to it that your soul is tortured forever in hell. I'm not sure you're even worthy of that. It's not even worthy of me to take my time to do a trial on your behalf. I'm just going to, on an ongoing basis, the scum I'm going to eliminate. Their souls are going to cease to exist. But this is ongoing. So this notion that God said, you know, one time I was grieved with humans and I got rid of them, and I'm never going to do that again, that's not the way he wrote it. So I thought that was pretty profound. The second part of it that was really surprising to me was written in the cohortative. The cohortative is first-person volition. I want to get rid of them.
Wow.
I wanted to obliterate them. Whoa. so much for God wants to save everybody. He's saying, I want to, no, he's not saying I want to save them. He doesn't say I want to help them. He's saying, I want to exterminate them. This is what I want to do.
So much for God loves everyone.
Yeah, so much for that, huh?
Yeah.
I mean, it's what we have come to expect. It's what we want. I mean, I want God to do this. I don't want to spend eternity with scumbags.
Yeah.
No, I need.
And so he's saying this is what he wants to do. So I thought it is exactly how we want God to be. It is what we want of eternity. It's what he wants in eternity. But while it is what we would have expected from him, this is pretty blunt even for God to say, I want to, on an ongoing basis, eliminate these people. Tells you a lot about who he is, what he thinks, what he wants. So anyway, I thought that was fascinating how it was written. And Yahweh said, I will eliminate on an ongoing basis, literally. This is what I want to do. The Adam
man. That would
man,
make sense. That would totally make sense. Sure.
It's what we've come to expect. It's what we want. It's consistent with his character. Now, what's also interesting here, and this is something that we ought to keep in mind, that, you know, that a lot of people get mad at and don't like the God of the Old Testament because he's a vengeful and wrathful God, you know, wiping people out with a flood. Well, this is a clue. If this isn't true, then you can't attribute it to God, and so you're wasting your time to attribute it to God if it's not true. If it is true, then it's God doing this. It's God wanting to do this. And who are you to say that God's wrong? But beyond that, this is this realization that it is God's desire to do this means that if we want to spend time with this God, if we like this God, if this is the God we want to spend eternity with, then we probably ought to have that same attitude. And if our attitude is different than that, then we are probably
part of the problem.
Yeah, exactly. So, here is saying that, and Yahweh said, I have chosen to consistently eliminate man, whom relationally I have created. And this is also important, that if I go into Kirk, your yard, and I cut down your trees, and I salt your yard, I've got no right to do that. It's not mine. I didn't plant it. I'd be wrong. But, you know, if I go into my vegetable garden and I choose to say, you know, those tomatoes are really yucky, and I just want to pull them up by the roots, I planted the daggone things.
Sure.
Mind uproot. It's no big deal. If I uprooted Larry's tomatoes, that would be a problem. But I'm not uprooting Larry's tomatoes. I'm uprooting my own tomatoes. Yahweh is not uprooting life that someone else created. It's life that he created.
Mm-hmm.
He has every right to do so, just as I've got the right to go into my garden and pull out the carrots. So, whom relationally I have created from the presence of the ground, it's Adama. And this is it's interesting because Yahweh had many words to choose for man. He chose Adam. And then he had many words to choose from world, Tabel, region, Eretz, and ground, Adama. But he chose the female of Adam. Adama and Adam, same word, it's just male and female.
Mm-hmm.
And so God is speaking of the ground as the as an aspect of Adam, from whence he came. You know, just like the Ish and Isha. The Isha is the female of Ish, female individual. Do we come from the male or the female?
Female.
Yeah, so he's saying, you came out of the ground. I made you out of the ground. I constructed you out of the elements of the ground. And so the very man here that he is going to eliminate, he's saying is the very individual who came out of the ground. He's tying man and the substance that he, of which he made us. And when he's doing that, what he's saying is, you're mortal, you're material, and you're never going to be anything more than that. I plucked you out of the ground. How I made you, and you're going right back to it. So there were lots of words he could have chosen, like Tabel world or Eretz land or region, but he chose Adamah, the female of Adam, to say this is from which you came and that's where you're going. You're never going to make it out of the material realm.
Now, is he also not making a distinction between the line of Adam and the creatures that were already there?
Absolutely. Yeah, mm-hmm. He would have used one of many words for mortal man, Enoch, for example.
Mm-hmm.
Or he could have used just ish individuals. But he used Adam as, these are the descendants of Adam and Chawa, absolutely.
Which is a very strong point based on you got people out here thinking Moloch were running around marrying women.
Right. Yeah. Which it does not say and does not infer.
And it doesn't say anything about Moloch. It talks about Adam's offspring here.
Right. The sons of God. Yeah, the sons of God. The children of Adam and Shawa. And you know, Yahweh looked at Adam as his son. That's how he created the whole concept of the garden and the relationship the two of them had. And it says, because man has preyed upon, continuously plundered and spoiled living creatures who move about, and winged creatures who fly in the sky. Indeed, because I am grieved, regretting having made them. Yahweh celebrates life. You know, when we move into eternity and Yahweh creates a new universe, even when we have the 1,000 years to explore the existing universe, I think we're going to find life everywhere. I think Yahweh is absolutely fascinated by life, loves life. And when we're hostile to life, we're hostile to the thing God enjoys most. Is, Larry, do you got a favorite thing?
Sure.
What if Kirk were to come in and smear paint all over and ruin, dent, maybe take a hammer to your favorite thing?
I wouldn't be very happy about it.
You know? Yahweh's favorite thing is life.
Yeah.
And man was taking clubs and bludgeoning life. God wants us to celebrate life. You know, it's like Satan's version is, let's destroy life. That's why it's Allahu Akbar as they commit deadly terrorist acts, killing people. Yahweh wants us to celebrate life. Got no problem with us killing an animal respectfully for the purpose of nourishment, but respect life. Don't go prey upon it. So that's what he's telling us here, that he grieved, regretting having created mankind because mankind did not value what Yahweh valued. In fact, man was destructive of God's greatest creation. The greatest creation of Yahweh is not the universe. It's life. That's why we don't know that the universe has a language that it, upon which it is constructed. But we know for certain that life does. You know, DNA is the language of life. Yahweh spoke it into existence. He used his favorite tool, life, based on language. So God is saying, I'm grieved, regretting having acted, engaged in this way, and having made them. But Noah, which means trustworthy guide to the resting place, in other words, this is an individual that can tell you how you get back to the Garden of Great Joy, the Garden of Eden, which is what Sukkah is all about, which is what the Promised Land represents. But Noah, the trustworthy guide, found, discovered, obtained, came to possess and experience Masa, favor, a fortuitous response, acceptance, mercy, compassion, and beneficial consideration in Yahweh's eyes from Yahweh.
You know, that's a giant passage right there. It really is.
Correct.
Obviously, Noah was doing what would have been in opposition to the rest of the people in that entire region.
Mm-hmm.
And that made him very rare. And that's, you know, sort of like the people in the covenant. I want to mention something here. Cherie is in hospice care at this.
Oh, I'm sorry.
Yes.
She's been a outstanding admin to Unpopular Truth.
Yeah, one of the great contributors to sharing Yahweh's message.
Yeah.
Sister.
And like Noah,
mm-hmm.
In opposition to the world.
Yeah. But it with great love for Yahweh and for her brothers and sisters in the covenant.
Yep.
Wow. Well, I'm both saddened that we will miss her for a short while, but delighted that she is going to go where we are going and get there before we get there.
How about that?
So we will find her waiting for us. Well, yeah, no doubt. So Noah found favor in Yahweh's eyes. This speaks to something that I have suspected. We've talked about on a lot of different programs. I can't prove it. I just think it's true. And this is what I think. I think is true. Is that whether it's, and I can't tell you which one of these two things it is. I can't tell you if Yahweh uses his ability to see the future, to know who is going to respond to him, who's going to respond positively. In other words, Yahweh knew that Abraham was going to respond as he did. Yahweh knew that Noah was going to respond the way he did. Yahweh knew that Moshe was ultimately going to respond the way he did. He knew that each of us were going to respond as we have. So is it, knowing that, is it, does Yahweh therefore become more assertive and helping us through that initial passageway where we come to know that religion and politics are wrong, and that not only do we have an interest in searching for him, but we stumble upon things that lead us in the right direction. Does Yahweh actually take an assertive role with those, A, that he either likes and wants to have a relationship with, or B, that he knows will respond favorably to him once they're confronted with information about him? I think that's what this is saying. Noah found favor in Yahweh's eyes. From Yahweh's perspective, this is someone that Yahweh wanted to spend eternity with. And so Yahweh made it possible, helped Noah along the way. I think that, at least, I have a strong suspicion that I didn't come to a relationship with Yahweh and leave religion and politics because of my own doing. I'm quite convinced that long before I knew Yahweh, understood the terms and conditions of the covenant, appreciated the Torah, God was already helping me come to know who he is and what he had to say.
Well, wouldn't that explain the disciples as well? I mean, he helped them for 3.5 years. He called them.
Correct. Yeah, he chose them before they chose him. Yeah. He knew how they're going to respond.
Yeah.
And so, I think that's the case here with Noah. I think that Yahweh facilitated his approach. And by the way,
there's a lot of people that try to say, well, the Torah must have been written by then because, you know, he was following the Torah. No, he was part of the Torah. He was somebody that would listen to Yahweh's instructions. Like,
right.
As an example, building an ark. You know.
Yeah, he was a living example of what the Torah of Yahweh represents and how we benefit from it when we listen to it and act upon it. So he's a living manifestation of the Torah. Abraham is a living manifestation of the Torah. So when you say that did the Torah exist during the time of Noah? Absolutely. What do you think the instructions that Yahweh is giving Noah are? It's directions. It's guidance.
Torah.
It's Torah. Mm-hmm. Absolutely.
That's what Torah means. What Torah means.
Right.
It doesn't mean this written book and that written book and that written book become known as
right.
the Torah. It's
right.
it's listening to Yahweh's words and instructions. And, I mean, that's... It's open proof of it here, the fact that Noah was listening to instructions. That is the Torah, you know.
Yeah, exactly.
That's it.
So, from Yahweh's perspective, Noah found favor. And he found favor, my guess is, my thoughts here anyway, I think that Yahweh recognized that Noah was disgusted by human religion and politics, and that Noah was absolutely willing to listen to Yahweh. And because of all of that, Yahweh said, this is somebody that I can work with. He communicated to Noah, and he knew that Noah would respond, but Noah found favor by responding, by listening and responding. I think that's how he found favor. I think Yahweh is just attributing it to it in advance. And Masa says that, you know, he thought about it, he discovered, he obtained, he came to experience, which is how we all come to this point. Then it says, you know, this is the genealogical record of Noah, who was an upright and blameless individual in his home. Noah was one who walked with God. You know what, when I've got Tamim, blameless here, it's the same word that Yahweh uses when he's talking to Abraham. And he says, you know, walk to me and be tamim. Yeah, walk to me and be tamim. And what all that means it says that he was upright and blameless. But blameless means that Yahweh took it upon himself to vindicate and make him perfect. But it's the exact same thing that is in the instructions of the covenant to Abram. Walk to me and become tamim. But the reason he was blameless is because he was tzedak. He was right. If you're right in terms of understanding what God has said, and you're right in terms of your response, you're tamim.
And you're right in terms of seeing a bunch of religious people act nonsensical and calling it that. Yeah, I mean, I think, you know, upright, tzedak, righteous could be, you know, a person based in reality. That might be another good word for it, too.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's right. Well, right means that you're reasonable, that you're rational, that that you've come up with the right answer. God's not teaching on outcome-based math here. There's a right answer. And Noah knew the right answer. And so Noah was considered blameless because his understanding of God and his response to God was right. Listen to what God has to say and act upon what he does. I don't find a single place where Noah said, oh, God, come on. That laminated wood, and that's just, let's cut some corners and just use some smaller beams. Or, come on, God, we're not going to put a door on the side of this thing. Are you crazy? And we don't need to build it that big. No. I mean, there's... You know, God, I don't want to do it that way. What about this way? No, it's
no, there's none of that. He listened to the creator of the universe and knew that the creator of the universe had the answers, and he didn't, and he simply followed those instructions, which is, you know, we're right back to what the Torah is about, looking at instructions. You know?
Exactly. I think we have Lisa on the line. She wrote me a quick note and says that Ms. Moore, Psalm 79, 6 through 13, explains what we've just read in terms of God's impression. Lisa, are you on the line with us? No? All right. Well, I thought that she was and wanted to invite her to contribute that if she was. Then it says here that Noah had fathered three sons named Shem, Ham, and Japheth. Now, what's interesting here is that it's three for two reasons. One of those reasons is that that three is important in the sense of father, mother, child. Three was important because it breaks down into a table of nations based upon what Yahweh had to say. But also, if each of those sons had a wife, and Noah had a wife, how many people do we have?
Right.
And what does eight represent?
Eternity.
Right. And isn't Yahweh establishing a covenant with Noah and his family?
Absolutely.
And so it would be an eight covenant or an eternal covenant. The region in God's presence was corrupt. It was Shahat, ravaged, ruined, devastated, and destroyed, becoming polluted, a slime pit of corruption and decay. And the Eretz land was filled with Malay, was overflowing with violence, destruction, and plunder, Hamas, terrorism and lawlessness, maiming and cruelty, killing, thievery, injustice, and looting, without any moral restraint. Bereshith, Genesis 6:11. And so this region of the world, where a man with an asama existed, was ravaged, putrid. Well, it sounds like what we got today, doesn't it? Corrupt.
Because it's close.
And it's filled with violence and plunder, terrorism and lawlessness, Torahlessness, if you will, no moral mm-hmm. restraint. Sounds like our world again, doesn't it? But you know, it's not, you know, there's a lot of people that like to talk about today's moral decay, and they will emphasize the fact that somehow, you know, this is the worst that man has ever been. You know, I don't know how many of you have watched the Discovery or History Channel programs on Rome and Greece and Sparta.
Yeah, they don't get a lot worse than all that.
No.
I mean, that's basically what's happening here is, so is in the beginning, so will be the end. They're just emulating those cultures that have already been here and already done that.
Yeah. Well, I read a lot of Roman history. And, boy, these people, they're tougher than we are. They're meaner than even we are.
Oh, man. Far more. In terms of sexual perversion, in terms of
torture
to other people, including that their caste system, where and their enslavement of others, their tendency to commit mass murder, their use of deception. And, I mean, there isn't. There just we're a killing machine, selfish, greedy, duplicitous. I mean, there's almost nothing that is worse in America today than was Rome. Mm-hmm. Yeah, there's some things that I think were as bad. But, oh, my. So it's mankind has grieved God. You know, if the problem was that the world was filled with violence and destruction and plunder and that it was corrupt and that's why God grieved, then I can't imagine anything different now.
No.
So you would expect God to respond. By the way, Hamas is the term for terrorism in Hebrew. You heard
it's also the name of the biggest terrorist group in
Israel,
in the
right?
area. Sure.
Yeah. Yeah. Tormenting Israel now is Hamas.
How odd is that?
Yeah, I know. It's just, I think it's delicious. God inspected, looked upon Ra, viewed the area, the region, the land. And indeed, it was corrupt and spoiled. This is Shahat again, ravage, ruin, devastate, and destroy. For all related human flesh treading upon the earth had become putrid, a polluted pit of corruption and decay. Now, it's important here to understand that God wasn't being capricious. You know, with all of the really despicable religions and paganism, their gods and goddesses were always capricious. You know, that somebody stole somebody's consort, or you know, showed up at a party earlier, or took you know a greeting gift, did something. You know, was an insult, and you know they went off and had a tizzy fit and tried to wipe out a whole world. That's just the nature of it. God is saying, no, I'm really deliberate here. I've taken the time to inspect the situation. He said now twice, Ra'ah, that I have viewed this situation. I've looked upon it. I know it's there. I've looked throughout the region. And indeed, he, truly and surely. And then he's emphasized for the fourth and fifth time, man was corrupt, spoiled. And they become putrid and corrupt. And so God is saying that I'm not being rash here. I'm not being impetuous. I'm just telling you that this is the situation. I've evaluated it, and there is no solution for it. Can't fix it. You know, when we tried, you know, all those years in Shattering Mist, tried to reach out to people, wake them up. You know, and I read something today that I found really irritating. I'm not a fan of Donald Trump. Donald Trump said that, you know, there is a correlation between Islam and terrorism, and that we in America ought to register Muslims. You know, if you're going to be a Muslim, you ought to be registered so that we can keep an eye on you because, you know, after all, Muslims are committing 99% of terrorist acts. He made that statement, and he, as a result of making the statement, he dropped 12 points in the opinion polls of Republicans.
Really?
The fastest, biggest drop ever. And on YouTube,
well, that wasn't exactly PC now, was it? You know,
no.
I mean.
But he's never been PC.
Yeah.
But there's something, and there's something with evangelical Christians who represent 40% of the Republican Party, where the one place that an evangelical Christian will not allow you to tread in terms of being on not politically correct is when you criticize any religion. And it's almost like they're scared to death that if you find flaw and criticize a religion, that you'll go after theirs.
Mm-hmm.
And all of the agnostics, when he said that, said, oh, we have to, you know, prevent this man from becoming president. And if you're religious, you know, he'll come after your religion next. You know, if you chip away at one religion, then it'll be the next one, and then the next one. And I just thought it was revealing.
None of them even realizing that religion is the enemy, their religion
correct.
Included. Yeah.
Correct.
So that would make the world in what kind of shape if we had no religion?
Oh,
very
if we had
good.
No religion, we'd be back to the Garden of Eden.
Yeah,
I mean,
religion.
You could just eliminate religion. And politics is a putrid thing as well. A putrid, polluted swine pit of corruption and decay, if I can use Yahweh's terms. So God said, so God said to Noah, I am pruning all humans who are related, Bashar, moving about before me. Indeed, the region is filled with Hamas, terrorism, lawlessness, and cruelty. Because of their presence, look here, now, I will bring ruin to them along with the region. So now six times. God has said that they are putrid and fixated on terrorism and cruelty. God doesn't like it when we're cruel. That's why we know what religion is, manifest cruelty. Let's go and sodomize little boys. Let's go and gang rape little girls. Let's engage in the slave trade.
All in the
name. And kill people. Yeah.
All in the name of that religion. You know, people could say other religious people do that. Yes, they do. And they try to cover it up.
Right. And, well, Roman Catholicism for 1,000 years was extraordinarily cruel. I mean, they invented some of the most cruel instruments of torture ever known to humankind, and it was a terrorist approach.
Extortionists.
But, yeah, so Roman Catholicism for a long time, and today Islam, is just flat out cruel. I mean, it's just cruel. But look at the United States engaging in torture, mm-hmm. bombing hospitals. You know, we've become cruel. So this is now the sixth time Yahweh has reemphasized this. This is the nature of man, cause, consequence. With the consequence, I'm going to bring ruin to them. Mm-hmm. They have ruined my creation. They have preyed and been cruel to life, so I'm going to ruin them. It's the quid pro quo of Yahweh. Everything, you get what you deserve. You reap what you sow. You know, you're going to choose to be cruel and ruin life. God's going to ruin your life. Going to wipe you out.
But they kill all the land, too, and they kill all the animals. I mean, there's no stop on this stuff. I mean, like today, they kill the oceans. It's everything.
Yeah, look what we've done. You know, there's a section of the Atlantic Ocean down between the Africa and South America that is a continent of pollution because of the way the currents work. It's like like an Australia of pollutants that are just floating on the surface. Nobody sails through it. Just scum. Act and engage. Making for yourself a timber ark, wood ark, of resinous lumber and tar, of laminated wood. Construct stalls on the ship and cover her kafar, parts of her living quarters, and exterior in pitch. Over. Well, the first part of this is the most important part, and it's repeated throughout this testimony. Mm-hmm. Act and engage. Mm-hmm. Making for yourself. Asha. Ashana can be simply translated do. So you could say do for yourself a timber ark. But you know, I found that when Asha is translated act upon, engage in, you know, act, engage, make, do, but with the concept of acting and engaging, that it's far more appropriately translated no matter where it appears. And this is a great place because mm-hmm. the thing that caused Noah to be spared and his family to be spared and to find favor with Yahweh is that here was Yahweh providing instructions and Noah engaged. He acted upon them. That is what Ashah means. And it's repeated over and over again throughout this. So act and engage, making for yourself. He didn't say make for me. Make for yourself. Do this for yourself. A wooden ark, a boat, a ship, which is waterproof and afloat, of resinous lumber and tar, gopher. And when you study gopher, one of you find is that it is a combination of a word for cedar, which would be the most durable wood of the time, and logs with a high resin content. So, in Aramaic, for example, the sister language of Hebrew, it means laminated wood. It would have been impossible for Noah to have brought the size of the planks and cedar to the construction site and then lifted them in place. Impossible. But if they're glue lamps, absolutely possible. And you know, a glue lamp is significantly stronger than a solid beam of wood.
No, I didn't know that.
Oh, significantly stronger.
That's what they say on this whole house.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Glue lamp is significantly stronger in construction. You know, when they, if you have a choice between a solid wood beam and a glue lamp, you always want to choose the glue lamp. It's truer, straighter, and far stronger. So not only is the glue lam a much better construction material, but the glue lam enables guys with arms and hands and no mechanization to construct the ark. So the glue lam here is essential. And the fact that it was covered with pitch tells us two things. One is that if you don't coat the seams of wood with pitch, then the ship is just going to sink. It's going to go right to the bottom of the ocean because the water is going to fill in the void, which the water that's being displaced, the air inside of the ship, it's just going to seep right in. It's going to pour in. It's pitch that keeps that from happening. Now, we know that now. They didn't know that then. And beyond that, what pitch says is that, you know, animal life had died millions and millions and millions and millions of years ago. And it had been compressed in heat and pressure, and it formed pitch. And so this idea that Noah existed 1,000 years after the earth had existed, then there wouldn't be any pitch.
That's a good point. I mean, that's an insane possibility to begin with.
Yeah,
but
yeah.
Sure.
But pitch is a material very much like asphalt today. You know, asphalt is without the sand and without the grit, but it's just a really sticky petroleum product. And these are her production relationships. The ark's length, 300 cubits. Her width, 50 cubits. And her height, 30 cubits. Now, using the Royal Egyptian cubit known to Moshe, which was 20.6 inches, the ark would have been 515 feet long, would have had a beam of 86 feet, and would have been 52 feet high from her keel to the roof line of her deckhouse. Now, Lur, I know you've shared this on a number of your programs because it's so telling of Yahweh, but how would the ark's ratio of her length to her width compared to, say, maybe the Nimitz aircraft carrier, a Nimitz-class aircraft carrier?
It would basically be identical, basically.
How about the World War II? The engineering powerhouse of the world was Germany. She made her ultimate ship, the Bismarck. You know what the dimensions, if you take the length and width of the Ark and you compare it to the length and the width of the Bismarck, how do they compare?
0.15 to 1 would be the Bismarck, and I think it's 0.17 on the Ark. They would be almost identical.
Correct. And the largest oil tanker, this would be the Seawise Giant. So this is the largest vessel man has ever made for conveying product. 0.15 to 1. Again, it's identical to the Ark's dimensions.
Which is, you know, unbelievable. You know, you're talking about a guy landlocked 1,000 years ago, you know, I mean.
Yeah.
How would he know these engineering?
It wasn't exactly an engineer or boat maker.
No,
well, it's one of the reasons I've said you don't have to find the Ark. I always wondered why the dimensions were in there. Of course, now I understand it. But you don't have to find the Ark. If you got the dimensions, that's the proof. I mean,
correct.
That's straight up the proof.
Right. And it wasn't there was nothing even remotely that size made in the ancient world. And nothing of those dimensions was made. It was radically different than anything that existed even 2,000 years later, 3,000 years later. So engage by building a roof to the point of a cubit above the completed ark. Place a doorway of the ship in her side. Construct lower ones, a second and third. Now, the last thing you would ever put on the side of a ship is a...
Is a doorway.
Yeah. Correct. A doorway.
Yeah, the people on the Titanic.
Yeah. The last thing you'd want to put in the side of a ship is a doorway. But what does the ark represent?
Yeah,
doorway to God. Yeah, doorway to God was home, right? A doorway to the covenant. So it's a doorway to come. It's got to have front and center, right in the middle of the daggone thing, a doorway, because that's what it represents. He's telling you the ark represents a doorway. Now, the next sentence, we don't have it in the Dead Sea Scrolls. So it's, we don't know if he was saying, I want three doorways, or if he's saying, I want three floors. If he has three floors, you know, you're talking about the three kind of levels of Yahweh. Yahweh the Father, the entirety of Yahweh, all seven dimensions, all power, all everything. And then, you know, you go down a notch and you have the set-apart spirit, and you go down a notch from that, and you have the most set-apart Yahusha. Three floors. Three different levels of Yahweh, if you will. All Yahweh, there's three different levels of Yahweh. So three floors. That was what it would represent. What do you think three doors might represent?
Might represent the same thing.
No, I don't think so. I don't think
there are
so.
Three options.
There you go. What are the three options for the three destinations? Well, in fact, I even referred to it as the three doors.
Mm-hmm.
What are the three doors? You can spend
Yahweh, away from Yahweh, and non-existence.
Mm-hmm. Correct.
Good point.
I think
yeah.
the three doors, I think he's telling you. That, I mean, this was a life and death choice right here.
Sure was.
There were people without an Asama outside of this region who were going to live and just die. And there were people who were leading people away from God that were going to be... spend eternity separated from him, and then there were those that ate on the ark that were found the doorway to life eternal with Yahweh. Yeah.
I have a feeling it is three decks, though. I really do, but that's just my take on it. I think that that's probably the stronger statement being made there, because I think there's one doorway into the covenant.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
That's my take, anyway.
Yep. Now, we don't know for sure. Your speculation certainly resonates with me. Given the option of when communicates, the intent usually is to read something on many different levels, consider all the possibilities. And so, well, if I had to pick one, Larry, I'd pick the one you chose. I kind of like the idea of being open to all possibilities because,
you got to be. You got to have an open mind in this business.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, it's just the way it is. So, when I say business, I mean family business.
No, I don't know. This is business. This is God's business we're talking about here.
Yeah.
It's not a business of God. No, so I have no problem with the concept of business. So, if I were to pick one, I would agree with you. I just have a tendency not to want to pick one because I kind of like them all. So they all kind of tickle my fancy from a different point of view. Behold,
hey,
I will bring... Yes?
Hi, it's Jason.
Hi, Jason. Yeah.
From Toronto. Now him.
Yeah. No, I know. I recognize your voice, Jason.
Yeah. Yeah, I'm glad... you're still going to be doing the Yada Yahweh radio show. I actually always liked it more than the Sharing This show, but it was a good run.
It was a good run, and we're going to do more of this. The Yada Yahweh program, we're not going to just continue the Shabbat show, although I'm going to be a scallywag the next 2 weeks. I'm going on a 30-year reenactment of my honeymoon, same ship that my wife and I were on our honeymoon. We're going to spend 2 weeks on this cruise ship. Same exact ship we were on 30 years ago. So I'm going to do that for the next 2 weeks, but then I'll be back. We're going to continue this program, but Kirk and Larry and JB and then also Richard for posting and also Mad Dog. Steven, the handle? Oh, Bloodbath is what he uses. Steven, Bloodbath. Yeah. Not Mad Dog, but Bloodbath. I don't know why I came with Mad Dog, but Bloodbath is the, if you look in the...
That's one of the finer wines out there.
Yeah, but if you look in the chat room under Bloodbath, it's actually Steven. You've been out
okay.
with Stephen, but Stephen has also agreed to post them. Richard has agreed to post them, but we're going to, the group of us are going to record programs that are focused on Yahweh's testimony. We're only going to go to news if there's something that's just happened in the news that's just extraordinary. And, you know, we're always, when you're talking about Yahweh's testimony, you're always interweaving current events into his prophetic testimony because he's talking about current events. But for the most part, we're going to focus on Yahweh's testimony, and we are going to produce what hopefully will turn out to be, between this show and the other two recordings, about 5 hours of archives or recordings each week. That'll be new each week. That'll be posted commercial-free on those two sites.
Well, that's great, because I can hardly listen to regular radio anymore. It's you know, I listen to your shows pretty much exclusively. But I'm looking forward to you know, contributing and stuff too. Actually, I finally bought myself some original language software.
Great.
I'm working a lot, but I'm going to go through some of the tutorials this weekend, and hopefully I'll be able to contribute. You know, I've been listening for a long time. I've been benefiting a lot from you know, everybody else sharing what they're learning and whatnot.
Right around the end of the year. In fact, everyone who's listening here, right towards the end of the year, first of next year, if you'll send me an email at yadayahweh or email@yadayah.com, or just go to the Yadayah site and click on contact us, it comes to me. But yada or email at yadayah.com and say, here's my contact information. I would also like to participate when you do the recordings for this program. Like, Lisa,
okay.
I know that we tried to get your comments on the thing that you had sent me today. We just, for some reason, the technology didn't work for us. But if you can do that, then we can. We'd really like to have callers like we had on Shattering Myths, but people that are part of the family talking about this, and the more contributors, the better. So if you send me an email towards the end of this year, first of next year, Scott is going to coordinate the recording, and we will absolutely have you be part of the program. The more, the merrier.
Great. Looking forward to it. I did have something to add to the conversation tonight.
Please.
And I just jumped in. I didn't hear, like, a lot of the first half hour or so because I was putting my daughter to bed and whatnot. But I had posted something about the covenant and its connection with Noah and the flood story. But you know, I was listening to it was one of the last recordings of Ron Wyatt before his death.
Yeah.
And you can find it on YouTube if you search I think they call it Deathbed Confession or something like that, of Ron Wyatt.
Okay.
It's hard to make out. It's a very poor recording, but if you listen carefully, he mentions, and I don't know if he mentions it anywhere else, but in that chamber that he found himself in, where the Ark of the Covenant was,
right,
and the other artifacts, along the back wall, it was a crystalline, on the back wall, that was the colors of the rainbow.
Wow.
Yeah, and you'd have to go there and you can hear it for yourself. He explained that he had somebody call him, and he had a dream because he had been asking to see the Ark or something like that. And Ron White was very reluctant to give any information out at that time, but he described the room perfectly and said that he was mesmerized by this rainbow-like kind of crystal coating on the backdrop of the chamber.
Wow.
Well,
the reason that's so profound, I'm sure, Kirk, your resonating with you, is that we devoted a better part of a whole Shattering Myth program to what the rainbow represents. And we talked about it at length on this program last week.
Last week,
the rainbow breaks light into its seven component parts. It's Roy G. Biv, red, orange, yellow, green, blue, indigo, and violet. And so here is the symbol of the sign of the covenant is light, and light broken into seven component parts. And then for Yahweh in the room where the Ark of the Covenant sits, to have that same rainbow, which is the sign of the covenant, presented on the back wall of the room as a silhouetting the Ark is just...
I don't know if you could find it in the tent of meeting or anything like that. But somebody who prepared the room ahead of time, Solomon, they must have made the same connection. There's definitely a lot of parallels there. So I just thought it was interesting to point out. Because I had taken a position in the forum, I was arguing the latter, and I was saying, well, here are the differences between the covenant with Abraham and the covenant, what he calls the covenant with Noah, and, you know, his seed after him, and you know, the animals and this kind of thing. So I had posted that in the forum, and I wasn't even dogmatic about it. Like, I was just, that was something that jumped out at me, and I was kind of sharing, like, my opinion on it and whatnot. After I heard that, I was just thinking, like, okay, well, perhaps there's a little more to the story, so.
Yeah, mm-hmm, I actually came to the conclusion recently, and it was through discussions with Kirk on Shattering Myths, that there really was no difference between the two, and that the covenant with Noah was exactly the same, as Yahweh providing very specific instructions, first to disassociate from the institutions of man which were corrupt, to trust and rely upon Yahweh, to walk to him, to come to him in a manner that would make him perfect, to closely examine and carefully consider the instructions related to this covenant relationship and act upon them, and to be circumcised, to have a sign that sets you apart from the world. And in the case of the sign of the covenant is the seven components of light, which was the very thing that made the difference with Abraham. Abraham didn't get the covenant at all, did not know what he was inheriting, complained to God and says, I don't understand this. And then Yahweh showed him light and took him to the spiritual realm and said, this is what you're inheriting. And that's when Abraham got it and understood.
Yeah.
So recognizing that the rainbow is light broken into its seven component elements, and that was the deciding factor for Abraham in understanding what the covenant was offering. I've come to see them as exactly the same. One is just a dress rehearsal for the other. It's like Abraham going to Mount Moriah with Yitzhak, his only son, and about to take his son's life upon the wooden altar there, and Yahweh was saying, "Don't, I will provide the sacrifice." And then there was the ram stuck in the thicket by its horns and its antlers and its horns, yeah. And you recognize, wait a minute, this is in the exact same place as an absolute. Consistent presentation of what's going to happen on Pesach. Maybe I'm reading too much into it, but boy, it seems to me like that there isn't a different dispensation. It's exactly the same covenant. In fact, even if you go to Adam and Chawa in the garden where Yahweh provides instructions, you know, these are the things you can do, these will be beneficial. If you do this, it's going to create separation. And if you listened to Yahweh and acted upon what he said, you were going to live forever with him in his home. But if you didn't, if you rejected what he said, you weren't. Now, how is that any different?
Yeah, no, yeah, exactly. There's a lot of parallels there. I think at the time in the forum, I pointed out a few differences just with, you know, the fact that he mentioned the animals, too. He was making the promise to you know, all the living creatures on the earth. And two differences like
yeah,
that. But,
you know, I think
you know,
that
like
if you look at Sukkah is going to be a celebration of life, and we're told that the animals are going to be part of it.
Yeah, he loves them.
And you look at the covenant with Yahweh in the Garden of Eden, what is the one thing that we know that Yahweh celebrated with Adam?
All the animals.
All the animals.
Yeah.
So, you know,
yeah.
You know,
yeah,
here we are.
You're saying
exactly the same thing. It's, I'm gonna, I just see it's a celebration.
Yeah, I'm not holding to any, yeah. Yeah. Yeah, it's definitely interesting. Anyways, I'll check that out.
By the way,
it's,
you know, I think that metaphors for things don't have to be identical.
In fact, it's
to
go further back in the story.
Right.
It usually tells
that
more.
That Adam and Yahweh in the Garden of Eden is simpler than the relationship between Noah and Yahweh and the ark. And that was simpler than the relationship between Yahweh and Abraham and the establishment of the covenant. And that was simpler than when Yahweh met with Moshe and said, you know, I'm going to add to this. I'm going to expand it. I'm going to shade it with all of the various colors so that you have a deeper and fuller appreciation of this. And I'm going to provide you even more guidance. More doesn't make it different. It's just that you go from the nugget of something to it beginning to grow and grow and grow. And Sukkah becomes the second to largest experience of the same relationship, with the largest experience when Yahweh creates the new heavens and new earth for us for all of eternity. I just think each time we go up, we're growing in the scope of the experience. Same experience,
yeah.
just each time in a greater dimension, if you will.
Yeah, as you go through the timeline, it becomes more elaborate. So,
yes.
Yeah, but
yeah,
you're
it's
just looking
like,
at
you know, if you plant an acorn, the little seedling that comes up, you know, it's an oak tree. But it's, you know, it's an oak shoot. And then you know, you look at it 10 years later, and it's a little tree. And you look at it 100 years later, and it's a solid, massive tree. But you look at that same tree 300 years later, and my, you know, it's a whole ecosystem that's so massive. But same thing. It's just that it's a growing, expanded experience. And I think that's the difference between Eden and Noah and Abraham and Moshe and the grand celebration of Sukkah and overall eternity.
Mm-hmm. Yep. Yeah, and then there was the other point you made about when he speaks of the covenant, it's in singular form.
Mm-hmm.
So.
Yeah, always in the singular form.
Yeah.
Yep, and since covenant is synonymous with family and home, it says that God only has one home, one family.
This is going to be the biggest challenge for me, actually, now that I'm going to be diving into more of the original language stuff. Is where would you find be the best source for me to just get a grasp on, you know, what we know about Hebrew and what the grammatical rules are, so I can read the lexicon fluently at least, and then from there maybe I can.
What I do is, and this is I think is the most helpful, is the single most important tool. And I know you do this a lot, Kirk, and you've done it a lot, maybe. So maybe you have a different approach. But my approach is I always start with an interlinear, and I like to start with a heavily burdened interlinear. By heavily burdened, I want my interlinear to the greatest extent possible, provide a very stiff, literal rendering so that I'm looking at each word and I know, is it prefixed or suffixed with a pronoun, and what was the pronoun? You know, is it singular or plural? Is it feminine or masculine? Is it first, second, or third person? So that's one of the very first things I want to do in the interlinear is I want to make certain that it's providing me with the pronoun, and whether the pronoun is first, second, or third person, masculine or feminine, singular or plural, because then you know what the word is associating with. The next thing I want to do is on verbs is I want to always consider the stems, the conjugations, and the moods. And if you're looking at stems, you want an interlinear, and most of the interactive interlinears will provide you with the stem, the conjugation, and the mood. And I find that it's helpful, with exception of the called stem, which is the most frequent, to always look them up. I don't care how many times you've looked up the hifle or the niffle or whatever it may be. Look it up. Because each time you want to walk through the process. Okay, this one is saying that the subject causes the object to participate in the action of the verb as if a secondary subject. Yahweh does things with us. When we engage with him, we receive the same benefits from the action of the verb that he does. We participate right along with him. There are lots of these stems that tell us the relationship between the subject, who is often God, and us as the object.
Have you gotten
really
to the point now? Go ahead, sorry.
It's really important on moods to understand, the one I was talking about, the cordative, that's first-person volition. There's first, second, and third-person volition, so you need to know who is making the choice. Who is expressing their will? Does God want us to make the choice, or is this him expressing his desire?
Right.
So I think that is really important, and I think there's very few things as important as knowing the conjugation as to whether this is a one-and-done or it's an ongoing, habitual, unfolding reality.
Are you of the opinion that the lexicons are, for the most part, they can be relied upon? Or do you think they've taken the language and built their own grammatical language?
If you begin with the interlinear, which gives you a foundation, then you go to the lexicons next. And on the lexicons, this is what I have found. JB and Kirk, you guys do a lot of translating, correct me if you think there's a better approach. What I do is I have two favorite lexicons. The Dictionary of Biblical Languages and Strong's are my two favorites. They're favorites for different reasons. One is I like the way that Strong's transliterates words. And so I like the spelling in Strong's. They do a better job of transliterating so that you know exactly what Hebrew letters. I can read the Hebrew letters, but just to transliterate it in a consistent way. And Strong's does a good job of presenting roots. I always study the root. I will never translate any word without considering the root. And then the Dictionary of Biblical Languages, because it provides a more comprehensive list of meanings of the words, less encumbered by the translation. It'll tell you this is the meaning, first, second, third, fourth, fifth, sixth meaning of the word, and it is not based upon or trying to justify an existing translation, so it usually won't give you something that's bogus just because it's in a translation. And Strong's is horrible at that. And then what I do is that I look at every, and I use typically the Dictionary of Biblical Languages. It's just set up the way it's easier for me to do this. I look at every word that is comprised of the same letters. And I'll be very careful that if I'm using an electronic lexicon and I'm linked to a particular word, I'm always careful to say, that word may have been written using the same letters but vocalized five different ways by the Masoretes, and I better look at all of them. and then
I
look at
I would totally do that, yeah, because as far as when it comes to all those little notches they build on the words, I would discredit them as soon as I could.
That's what I do.
Like, disregard them.
Right, yeah, to disregard them or discredit them. And you do that by looking at all the other words and all the potential meanings of words that are written with the same letters. Then the next thing that that I always do on these is you realize that there are some basic concepts that are conveyed, like or light. And or light, which appears in a lot of different words. And so L for Almighty appears in a lot of different words. And so I begin to look at the components of the word to form a better understanding of the word. Like Ish-Sarael. There is no place that will actually tell you that Ish-Sarael is Ish, the Hebrew word for individual. Sarah, based upon the mother of the covenant, Sarah, which means to engage and to endure, El, which means Almighty God. No one will tell you that. They'll tell you that it means to wrestle with God, and it doesn't. And so, you know, you have to cut through a lot of garbage, and it takes a lot of time to do it.
Yeah.
Guys, what would you say? Did you do this different than that?
Well, I started out, Jason. I read everything that Craig had written over and over and over again. And then I decided, well, if all those words mean, I started looking up all the words, just period. I'd go from strong, and I had about five, I still have, five or more lexicons, and then I would look up each one of the words and see if that's what it really meant. And when there was a conflict, then I would try to figure out and resolve that. Long before I got into the actual grammar of it all, I got a couple of books on grammar, which helped. You know, I have to look at it all the time. I have little charts, and if they're not right in front of me, I'm liable to forget. So I literally, and then I found interlitteraries on the internet that are free, and you can use those and go right through, and then I would look up every word. And Strong's is really good. Most of the dictionaries and all that I have use a strong number or use a number that you can go from the strongs to the other number, you know, and so that I can read theirs. And then you just go through it all. But the thing that helped me most before I really began was I had a real good perspective on what was right and what he was keying on. It was absolutely, you couldn't argue with it. Now, I knew some of these things before I picked up his book. He just, just opened my mind to a ton more, but for me, I had to have a little bit of a perspective before I jumped into it, because second languages are not my thing.
Yeah.
But once I got it, and I figured out about the letters and all, and they confirmed it as well, and I was going, wow, this is the same story. Everywhere we look on it, it's better every time you look at it.
Yeah, I would always tell somebody, if you only have one lexicon, you're kidding yourself, you're wasting your time. Yeah, and so I mentioned, too, I use 12, and I checked them out in 12 different lexicons. And I also look and see what the letters themselves convey, because the letters themselves will teach us a great deal about the words. But if I were starting out, I would do it exactly like Kirk does it now, and I think, JB, you were in the same boat, which is that if somebody has already invested tens of thousands of hours, not only providing it, but explaining how the reasoning behind it and what these things meant and how they applied it and what this says, I think the easiest way is to start with what I've already written, look up those words yourself, get familiar with what I chose to disregard and what I accepted in those words, and it's just like riding a bicycle. Get about the process of doing it, and then once you're doing it, then go off on your own.
So that was kind of what I did. I would tackle the verse you had already translated. Yeah, I just ended up coming with a real rudimentary, basic translation. But then I would compare it to yours side by side and be like, okay, well, he got this different than I did. See if I can figure out how he came up with that. And so then I go through and start looking a little deeper, and be like, okay, I see what he did here. That makes sense. And so then, you know, that built my understanding up through that. And it was checking your translation at the same time, so I got to where I could trust them more.
And from there, I just kind of went to where now, you know, I know which resources to check. I'm like, okay, you know, do this, do that. You know, ignore the vowel pointing first thing. Start looking up every definition of that word, whether it's pointed one way or the other, and compare, you know, which one fits the context.
Yeah, you know, one of the things, too, that I did a lot of is that if I couldn't find a definition of the word that that made sense to me, I would go and I would look up how did Yahweh use the word the first time he used it, and the second and third and fourth time he used it. And I found that he had this tendency to define his terms. Like Zeroa was one of them. It's translated arms. But the first time that Yahweh uses it, it's the sacrificial lamb. And when you read it in context all the way through the Torah, Prophets, and Psalms, sacrificial lamb is the ideal translation, and that's how he rendered it the first time that he used it, and the second and third time. And so sometimes I just figure, you know, I don't think any of these things make sense. And so I just, I said, well, maybe I'm going to get lucky here in Yahweh to find the term for us.
Yeah.
Which
interlinear by name do you use?
You know, the tool that I use, of course, is Logos. With Logos, you have lots of different choices. The two that I have up all the time, because I really like interlinears, I have the ESV interlinear up, and I have the LHI interlinear up. LHI, I take my Logos and I break it into three blocks. So I you know, there's a layout thing on Logos that you can create your own layout. And I have a three-prong layout. On my left side, I have a word for word, every word that gives me, like, and this one I have the first verb is amar, which means to say. And I'm looking at my interlinear. It says it's a verb. It's written in the call stem. It was prefixed in the third person masculine singular, which would be he. And then in the wa consecutive. Now the wa consecutive here is the first word of a sentence. So it could be just wa indicates we're beginning a new thought. Consecutive usually conveys volition. Imperfect means ongoing behavior. I'm getting all this information on the word, and then I've got 12 lexicons up that define the word. Now, you know, I have translated amar to say 20,000 times. So, quite honestly, I'm not going to be as diligent on Amar as I would be on other words. And by the way, one of the places where Amar, though, really does speak to me is the Promised Land. It's Eretz Amar. And so Promised Land, where Amar can mean to promise, to say, to answer, but it's the land of Yahweh's speech. It's the realm of Yahweh's words. So what we call it, the Promised Land, it's really Eretz Amar. That's how it's written. Hmm. And Amar can mean promise. It can mean answer. It can mean, but its primary meaning is to speak, to say, to call. So it's the realm
land where Yahweh's speech.
Yeah. Yeah,
sounds like a place I want to be.
Oh, absolutely. So, you know, it's the connections is what really bring the translations to life. It's what makes the translation exciting is when you can say, all right, there's Amar, and every time I translate Amar, without exception, I always think of Eretz Amar.
Well, I thought about what I do as a project, and that's exactly what I would want to do is I just start doing my own translation, and that would force me to go through the whole process. So, you know, I know there's some things I can do with some word processors where, you know, I can find a word and I can replace, you know, I could like cut and paste a a text version of the ESV, for example, and then I could go in and say, wherever it says Lord in all capital letters, put Yahweh's name, and bam,
right,
it'll replace it every single time throughout the entire text.
Yeah.
So I was thinking
about
doing that.
Every lexicon will show Yod-Heh-Wah-Heh.
Yeah.
And we'll show you the symbols for Yahweh's name. And then in the lexicon, I mean, in the interlinear without exception, they'll say, they'll write Lord. And then following Yod-Heh-Wah-Heh, they'll put Yahweh.
Yeah.
In fact, here in this interlinear, it says Yahweh. The name the God of Israel gives to the Israelites through Moses. The name the God of Israel gives to the Israelites through Moses.
Maybe they had asked themselves where they got Lord. Where did Lord come from then? Maybe you ought to rethink what you put first.
And if you look up, and if you look up Strong, Strong has Yahovah.
It just can't take it loose.
In fact, and then they say the pronunciation of it is Yehovah.
Yeah, or even, you know, like
back in the day.
Zachariah is Lord 6,510 times, as God 4 times, as Jehovah 4 times, and variant once.
Yeah.
Unpronounced except with the vowel pointings.
Right. Thank you. You mean the show
hosts before the vowel.
Then it says information, Jehovah, the existing one.
Yeah.
And then they have Yod-Heh-Wah-Heh, and they have it as Yehovah. Variation 3068, written exactly the same way.
How does a wah? You know, I've seen them write it. I've actually debated a couple of people there that use the V, you know, they use the vav.
Yeah.
And I say, well, how do you pronounce that? And they write Yahweh. So they use a vav and then pronounce it as a wah. It's just an insane. So I said, so this is all about adding to the confusion, then, right?
Yeah. Correct.
Yeah, you got to let them go their way,
it's
right?
It's a V instead of a W. Shalom?
Yeah. It's just like Dode said, he mentions you don't.
Shalom.
Not to stand in these people's way. So,
yeah.
You know, hey, happy to see
you.
Man,
know, I said that I was going to leave in 20 minutes, and we've almost got an hour and a half in, but I'm disappointing my son, and that's not a good thing for me to be doing. So I'm going to bid you good night. I'll let you guys close down the show.
Finish the last
but, yeah, could you please do that? But and we'll pick up at this point. You guys can pick up at this point if you want to continue on the same topic for the next 2 weeks. But for the next 2 weeks, I will be on vacation with my wife.
Have a wonderful time.
Great. Well, thank you, guys. Thank you, guys. I'll see you in 3 weeks.
Yeah. Have a good trip.
Right.
Enjoy your family.
Happy Shabbat. All right. Thank you. Bye-bye.
Bye. Oh, by the way, Larry, I think I stumbled across that Yakuba guy online. Yeah, I couldn't watch it very long. It was a little too intense.
Well, which thing was that? I'm not sure.
I don't know. You were talking a couple times about the guy. You kind of you referred to him as like Barney Rubble.
Oh, yeah, with the U's, I mean, everything's a U.
Yeah, Yahuwah sure. Guy, I don't know.
Yeah.
I don't know, he seems to go, I don't know, I didn't see anything on Paul, and I was kind of like, oh, okay, well, where's he going here, like, if you don't bring that up.
Well, you know, when I look at the people that, you know, it's sort of like the Bob thing, you know, when I look at the translations where they decide that there's not an O sound, I mean, I've had, you know, hundreds of people in debates, and I'm sure pretty much everybody on FB has, where they'll be debating somebody, and they will say, you know, there is no O sound in Paleo-Hebrew. What do you mean there's no O sound? You know, so...
How do you get boy?
Yeah, how do you get...
Shalom.
They're a gooey... or a
so that's
or
the thing,
maybe
like,
a
you
guy.
Just look at the most commonly used Hebrew words that everyone who doesn't speak Hebrew knows. So many of them have that wa in them, making the O sound. Torah, shalom, goy.
Elohim.
You know, yeah. It doesn't matter. You may not know a single word of Hebrew, but you've heard someone use those words, and they all have the O in them.
Right.
Those are the most common words known around the world. Do you think maybe that they have it right, and it didn't change over years, and someone didn't note, hey, you know, some reason the Jews started changing it from this to this?
Yeah, Rabbi, I just try to stick to the facts. I mean, people are going to go their own way, right? I mean, I don't even let it bother me.
Yeah, it's not really a Yobel, it's a Yubel, you know, so on the Yubel year, Yub was reading the Torah, and his
you
friend
seem to have a hard time with
Shalom,
you
know.
Seem to have a hard time with the Ruach being feminine, too, and
yeah,
the first thing I thought of was just the fact that, you know how you have, you have Yahweh, Father. You have Spirit, and then you have Yahusha, the Son. And in the garden, you have how the Son will separate from the Father and Mother, start their own family.
Mm-hmm.
And you have, you know, Yahusha, who is separated from both. And you have some reference to, I don't know, I could be wrong. Is there any reference to Yahusha being like the whole bride thing? Is that a purely church thing? With the whole like bride and groom and Israel and
the boy uses a lot. Yeah.
Is it in the Torah, the prophets at all?
Mm-hmm.
Or is it just strictly in, you know, the Christian Bible?
I've only seen it quoted out of the NT, as they call it.
Yeah. Yeah.
So
I could be wrong there, but I just thought of
where it is.
It seems to be a lot more harmonious if the Ruach's feminine. I mean, first of all, if he made man and woman in his image, like,
mm-hmm.
what's he all getting upset about? But he was pretty upset. And he was all dressed up. He had all the gear on and the stuff.
Yeah, I had the religious, playing religious dress up. Yeah, I like that. You know, those are, of course, that's sign number one. We're dealing with a charlatan, you know, I mean, and it's always the case, you know.
I mean, if you just stick to the facts, though, and, you know, like, I'm totally open-minded about things. I come to my own conclusions, but if somebody's got a better conclusion, I just...
Well, you know, honor your brother and father,
you know?
I mean, that's the... honor your mother and father is probably the best instance of this. You know, you should choose to carefully consider, view as worthy and enormously valuable and significant accordingly the symbolism of your father and that which is represented by your mother for the purposes of continuously lengthening your days with and upon the Almighty's land, which relationally and as a blessing, Yahweh, your God, has actually given to you. Now, that's Shemoth 12. Now, you know, you consider...
How much of this, how much you got translated there, Larry?
Well, I...